Thanks very much, Valonia. Thanks very much for having me here. I'm really glad to get a chance to visit, stop by, and talk to you all. I hope that after the talk, you'll come to me with more questions and more suggestions and more ideas. I chose as a title something quite general, microscopic physics in graphene, because I really would like to try and cover several topics, actually four. I won't do the fifth one. I hope to get all four. We'll see how time goes by. I'd like to tell you about electrostatic confinement of carriers in graphene, about the use of graphene nanogaps for contact molecules, about experiments with niobium titanium nitride contacts on graphene, and finally about in situ TEM studies, where we do transport and monitor the structure in a transmission electron microscope simultaneously. So, quite a few things to talk about. Just to give you a little bit of background where I'm coming from, since many of you may not know, but for the last 10 years, I've worked quite actively on string qubits in gallium arsenide quantum dots. And here's a recent, or an example of our recent work, where we are able to read out, two electron spins in each of these two quantum dots in a single shot mode. We're able to push them together, form a singlet, separate them, verify that the spin states are opposite. We're able, if the spin states are opposite, to exchange them, make them rotate around each other, do two-qubit gates, do single spin rotations, and so forth. So that's sort of something that I've been doing for quite some time. And in these gallium arsenide systems, the main source of decoherence is that the electron spin interacts with the nuclear spins of the lattice. And there's no way in gallium arsenide to get around it by isotopic purification, because all of the isotopes of gallium and arsenide have a nuclear spin. So for some time, there has been a lot of interest in the community to explore systems where you could make quantum dots without nuclear spins. And actually, as of a year ago, I'm working on silicon germanium, where quantum dots are coming of age and becoming controllable. But already 5 years ago, I started to work on graphene, in part motivated by this possibility of building spin qubits, but of course, in larger part, motivated by all the unusual properties of graphene. And you'll see how we're doing on the quantum dots. They're still not yet at the stage where we can do any spin manipulation, but this actually may be possible in the future. So, what I said just now is long spin coherence times, potential for building qubits could be an interesting motivation for studying graphene quantum dots. More generally, you're now confining the Hack particles, you have the valid degree of freedom, you can look at interaction effects. So I think there's some potential for interesting physics in these systems, also quite separate from possibly building spin qubits. Looking at the quantum dots built so far, they mostly fall in this category here. This is an image from the Enzling group at ETH Zurich. This is an image from the Manchester group, where basically graphene was etched. So the light shaded parts are graphene. It was etched so that the small island is formed, connected with weak links to the reservoirs. And this formed then, basically made it possible to observe Coulomb blockade, see quantized level spacing, and so forth. In our lab, we've been following a slightly different approach, which is a combination of etching. So we etch a narrow ribbon, and then we put, the ribbon forms a band gap, or at least a transport gap, and then we put gates across to form barriers, and in this way also can form islands. Now, you can do a few things. Here is an example of a measurement from our own lab, and the experts will recognize this typical honeycomb stability diagram for a double dot, where this is the gate voltage controlling the potential of one dot, this controls the potential of the other dot, and at the so-called triple points, electrons can flow consecutively hop from one dot to the next and through the structure. at large bias, you actually can, this is a zoom in, at large bias over your double dot structure, you can actually get information on the level spectrum. If you see discrete lines running, for instance, parallel to the baseline, the spacing between them tells you what the level spacing is. And so this type of measurement shows that indeed we're able to see the condensed level spacing of these direct particles in graphene. Still, in all of these quantum dots, including ours, part of the extremities of the dots are basically edges of the graphene as well. And because they are etched, they are very poorly controlled, and they lead to a lot of disorder. And in fact, we noticed this in our measurements. When we try to make a single dot, oftentimes we make two dots. It's in fact too easy to see Coulomb blockade because of the large amount of disorder. So ideally, what you'd like to do is to do something like shown here, and actually in an early paper by Francois and colleagues, this was proposed and analyzed. Ideally, you would like to define quantum dots without edges, just purely electrostatically. And then, as far as we know, in the context of graphene, it means using bilayers so that you can open a gap with electric fields and then use the gates, after you have the gap, use the gates to create electrostatic confinement. Here's a paper of 4 years ago of our own group, or some results of our own group, where you build such a double-gated bilayer structure. So you've got the back gate and then a top gate, and the transport between the contacts saw a resistance that increased by several orders of magnitude at low temperature when we pushed up the electric field and opened this band gap. So resistances here are 10 megaohm and more, much higher than the inverse conductance quantum, and so that should allow us to form barriers and produce Coulomb blockade. We were interested to not only get rid of the edges, but also get rid of much of the disorder produced by the substrate. And my student Stanley Hosen spent several times in the lab of Philip Kim making suspended devices. You see some images here of what he made. This is a bilayer suspended above the substrate, and then a gate running across the bilayer and suspended above it as well. And then here are two contacts. But before, he went on to make complete split gate devices and look at Coulomb blockade. Another advance came out of the Columbia group, and this was that graphene on boronitride substrates can actually have very high mobilities as well. Not quite as high as suspended, but still very large, of order of 100,000 or so, or 50,000. And we just decided that this was going to be, in the end, more practical if we wanted to extend it to more complex gate geometries, several quantum dots next to each other, quantum point contacts to the side for charge sensing, and so forth. So this is the way we went, and we got a lot of advice from them and Pablo Herrera's group on how to do this transfer of graphene onto boronitride without introducing too much contamination, and started making devices. So our goal really was to get a structure where you have the silicon oxide substrate, you scotch tape boronitride onto it, then you scotch tape a piece of graphene somewhere else, transfer it, put it onto boronitride, and then put another piece of boronitride on top of that, and then do lithography to make gates. And somewhere in between, you should have contacted the graphene as well.
How thick is the boronitride?
So for the bottom piece, it's several tens of nanometers, or even thicker. For the top piece, we've actually also, so we just selected, they come out at random thicknesses with the scotch tape, and we select pieces also on the order of a few tens of nanometers. The reason we do that is that the electric field from the gates then extends or has an effect also more sideways. Now,
what do you use for the gate?
Titanium gold. Yeah. In the first attempt to make high mobility devices on boronitride, in the first attempt it was quite frustrating and basically got not very high mobilities at all, not really better than on silicon oxide. It became clear that the cleaning in our oven wasn't cleaning very well, and in fact, at the moment, we're beginning to look at other ovens and exploring solutions in this direction. But in parallel, my student Stan followed a suggestion of another student to clean graphene not by putting it in an oven and annealing or by current annealing, but by literally scraping off residues from the surface with an AFM tip in contact mode. And it works actually really quite well. Here you see an image of a device which was initially really quite dirty, much more dirty than they usually are. This is graphene on boron nitride. So this is the boron nitride, that's the silicon oxide. This piece here is graphene. And you see that, the area that we scanned with the AFM is indicated by the blue box here. And you see that outside the blue box, it's really very, very dirty. Luckily, this is unusually dirty. It's not usually that bad. But it makes it clear what the technique is doing. Because inside the square window, if we just scan our AFM tip back and forth, you see that deposits are left behind at the edges of that square. So you really shove the residues away. And what's interesting, it works when you're pulling with your tip on the substrate, but also when you're pulling with your tip on the substrate. So in this case, the tip is still in contact because of van der Waals forces and water that helps to keep it in contact. But in both cases, there is enough adhesion between the tip and the substrate, larger than between the residues and the substrate, so that you can literally broom and sweep clean the substrate. Now, this is just looking at the mechanical effect or at the cleanliness of the surface, but it also improves the electronic properties. So here you see an example of a measurement. This is just the Bagate scan before mechanical cleaning and after mechanical cleaning, and you see that the mobility has improved, and furthermore, the neutrality point has shifted towards zero. With these bilayer devices, where you usually get lower mobility than a single layer, we've seen up to 10,000 at room temperature and up to 35,000. Actually, that's even a lower limit because of the way we've measured it at low temperature. The boron nitride came from Japan, from Watanabe and Taraguchi. So with this cleaning methods, we then fabricated complete devices with geometries like seen here, where there is one gate, a very wide gate on this side, and then two gates coming in, which are supposed to form barriers over here. And then this gate in the sample wasn't connected, but it's supposed to just mostly change the potential of the island. So in these devices, we actually saw quite nice Coulomb blockade. So here you see just a gate voltage scan of gate 2 for this device. Now we're kind of changing both the barrier and the potential, but the effect on the potential is seen more rapidly or more readily, so that you get several Coulomb blockade peaks.
So what here? Where is your tinplate?
Everywhere underneath. So the entire the graphene flake is larger than this. Or actually, well, no. Sorry, that's probably not true. There is the substrate boron nitride, graphene, and then a large flake of boron nitride on top of that, and that's what you're looking at here. So the top layer that you're looking at here is the boron nitride, and the graphene is underneath, and you don't see it. And I don't know exactly. The perimeter, I should add that for the next presentation, where the outline of the flake.
How do you know that lithography that we performed?
We have markers that...
And you cleaned graphene before you put the next layer of boron nitride?
Yes, so the last step before putting the top layer is the cleaning.
Your peaks are not equidistant.
They're not equidistant. I'll show another image here where you see a two-dimensional scan where this is actually on another device where two of the gates are swept against each other. And in this case, they're fairly equidistant, not entirely, but they're fairly equidistant. And for the most part, if you take such 2D images, they are quite equidistant. And so what that's telling us is that the quantized level spacing contribution compared to the charging energy is fairly small, which is what we can expect because, you know, above the island itself, there is no gate. There are gates to the side, but not right above it. And of course, then there is the bottom gate, which induces doping in everything it sees. And so we think that the island is has probably a fairly high density. The back gate has we have a large back gate voltage, and then underneath the gates compensates with the large and opposite top gate voltage. But in the little island, there is probably a decent density, and if you have a high density system, then level spacings are going to be small.
Charging energy implies a relatively large dose, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the charging, glad you mentioned, I skipped over that. So the charging or the addition energies, let's say, are about 0.25, 0.3 millielectron volt. We still have to do the proper calculation, but if you would, you know, this diameter is like 250 or so nanometers, and if the if you build a device with similar dimensions in gallium arsenide, which has an even higher dielectric constant, you get addition energies of a few millielectron volt. So what we think is that, in contrast to gallium arsenide, where the dots are typically much smaller than the lithographic space between the gates, in this case, the wave function actually extends maybe even partly underneath the gates. And the reason is that the gaps are, of course, only moderate in contrast to gallium arsenide, where it's a real band gap of the semiconductor that you know, helps for the confinement.
But you have gates on the top, and you presumably have a gate on the bottom.
Yes, there's a back gate. Yeah.
And what's the distance to that?
That's the usual 300 nanometers, plus a little bit of boron nitride. So, yeah, I should have. There is a device image here, but that's probably not very clear. Shall I make a drawing, or is it?
Oh, it's clear.
Yeah, it's okay. So there's a back gate, which is, let's say these are positive voltages. So the back gate is at minus 50 volts. The top gates are at roughly plus 10 volts. So underneath the gates, the graphene is, or the bilayer is charge neutral. And since we have a gap from the electric field, it means that the fermi level is inside that gap. And so there is very little transport underneath here. It's also the reason why we make these pieces of metal very wide to suppress strongly the parallel conduction that might happen underneath.
Do you know where you are in the conduction band or development with the Fermi energy?
So underneath the gates, the Fermi energy is mid-gap, and inside the island. So this is with negative backgate voltage. So it's p-doped, and so here it's p-doped, and here it's going to be a little bit less, but also p-doped. A little bit less because of the vicinity of the gates. So just for comparison, some of you may have seen a recent preprint from Amir Jacobi's group. They actually went all the way with a suspended approach. And so you see here an image, it's made by Monica Allen, where you see, well, not really, but there is a suspended flake here, and then four gates coming in. Other devices have just two gates. And they also see Coulomb blockade. I think actually, and here a gate scan of, you know, one of the gates versus another of the top gates. Actually, when I first saw their paper, if you look at their paper, there are other data taken in high magnetic field, and those look better behaved. But the zero field data, which is what we can compare with our data, in the end probably looks fairly comparable. You know, the Coulomb diamonds, the regularity or irregularity, also some tiny little diamond, and the lines are not completely straight. Their data is splitted a little bit more. We have to see. But maybe initially when I saw their data, I thought that the suspended devices were still much cleaner than those on the border nitride. Now I'm not so sure. Maybe it's actually comparable. Now, like I said before, seeing Coulomb blockade in graphene is generally easy because of this order. But much harder is to see quantized conductance because there, this order actually hurts you. But in this device, we actually did see quantized conductance. So this is a pinch-off trace where we sweep on the horizontal axis these two gates together to sort of narrow down that constriction. And then we step, that's the different traces, we step the voltage on this gate. And this gate was just shift, you know, stepped from 0 to 7 volts, whereas you need about 10 volts to get, to suppress the transport underneath. In other words, even though that gate sits close to this one, on this end it's just open, basically. Electrons can go through, and the transport is mostly limited by the barrier over here. It's just that the pinch of voltage, or you know, the position and gate voltage of these traces is shifted if we change this gate, and that's what you see here. And you see several plateaus. Actually, there was the Nature Physics paper from Bartman Race Group last year where they had a suspended piece of graphene and sent a large current to make a narrow constriction. They didn't quite know what it looked like, but also their evidence of quantized conductance was seen. This is again their zero field trace, which I think is not really, probably not nicer than ours. At finite fields, you know, the plateaus became a bit better visible, and you saw better
the quantized.
For them, it was monolayer. All right, so moving on to the second topic, graphene nanogaps. This actually is an experiment that was done in collaboration with Herre van der Zandt in Delft, who works, among other things, on molecular electronics. And it started when my postdoc, Emilia Barrero-Meghino, was passing large currents through few-layer graphene in hopes of seeing the conductance decrease in steps as layers would be burnt off one by one. Instead, what she saw is that a constriction was formed in this few-layer device, and eventually it ruptured. But like I will show you, she could do it in a very controlled way so that the gap was small enough that later molecules could be deposited and bridge that gap so that transport can be studied, or transport studies can be done through the molecules. Of course, there is a large field doing this for a living, molecular electronics, and mostly they use metal contacts. There's a little bit of work on carbon nanotubes or other contacts, but it's mostly metal. And metals like gold, you know, which is used because it's noble, the atoms at the end, at the surface, are very mobile. And at room temperature, these devices are really quite unstable. And if you take a scan and you repeat it, you get a different result. In contrast, the covalent bonds of the graphene are very stable, even at room temperature, or gives very stable devices, even at room temperature. So that would be nice. Another potential advantage is that for monolayer or few-layer graphene, the effect of the back gate voltage, which you use to gate the molecule, is screened less than it is for conventional metal contacts, where you have two big pieces of metal and a molecule sitting kind of on the tiny gap on top, and you can't really control the transport with the back gate. And then finally, potentially, the graphene structure and composition can help to anchor certain types of molecules. So here is the procedure. This is a procedure that's been used in other systems before. So Amelia, she ramps up the bias, the source drain bias, so that the current obviously goes up. And at some point, the current drops. And as soon as it drops by a few percent, the bias is taken back to zero in 10 milliseconds or so. So there's some feedback. And it's taken to zero. And then she gently brings it up again. and does this repeatedly, and in this way the conductance decreases gradually, so constriction is formed and gets narrower and narrower, until, well, she keeps doing this until the resistance is, let's say, between half a gigaohm and 10 gigaohm. And when that's the case, if you then take a source drain scan, you get here the high resistive part, like the 10 gigaohm or the 1 gigaohm, and a larger source drain voltage, you see that current starts flowing, and it actually fits quite well to a tunneling model, which is the red dashed line here. So this is just a Simmons model, which is usually used to describe such situations. And from the fit, and actually just from the bare fact that you see a current at all, we can deduce that the gap, the spacing between the electrodes, when done in this careful way, is just 1 or 2 nanometers, so really very narrow. Here's an AFM image. The graphene is a few tens of nanometers, a few tens of layers thick in this case, and the AFM isn't really able to probe the few nanometer gap. But what it tells us is that the constriction sits, actually it's not very visible in this image, but it sits usually halfway between the metal contacts, which is what you expect because the metal contacts evacuate the heat, and in the middle it gets the hottest. And furthermore, the constriction seems to form kind of coming from the edges towards the middle, which is also what you might expect because the atoms at the edges are the least strongly bound to their neighbors. This is done in air, by the way, so it's really a burning process. Now, without depositing molecules, there is no gate dependence. There's no gate dependence. In fact, sometimes she still sees a tiny gate dependence that tells us that there is still a tiny bridge crossing the two pieces, and then she applies a bit more current until it completely breaks, and then there is no gate dependence. So here is the same or a curve again before deposition of molecules. Then she puts it in a solution. This is I'm saying she, but it's together with Ferry Prince, Harris student. So they put these molecules in a solution, immerse the sample in the solution and take it out and blow dry it, and then in most of the devices. In a little bit less than half of the devices, the conductance increases after putting them in the molecules, which means that in those devices, a molecule, or maybe a few, happens to sit in that gap and bridges the gap. Furthermore, in some of them, you get a gate voltage dependence. So here you see different traces taken at different gate voltages, and this is all done at room temperature, so it really shows transport through the molecules, gate voltage controlled, and again very very stable.
Is there any water left?
The measurements themselves are done in under vacuum.
So water, you got rid of water.
Mostly. Yeah. If we do the same experiment without molecules, or with just a solvent and no molecules in the solvent, then there is no change compared to the bare gap. So it's really the molecules that make the difference. If you measure a device and you measure it again a few weeks later, the traces will be no different within 10% or so. So really quite reproducible, much more than with gold. Finally, we also did some measurements at low temperature. So this is an example where you actually, so this is source drain and gate voltage, and it looks like part of a Coulomb diamond measurement, although the gate voltage range that we dare to go and also the source drain voltage range that we dare to go doesn't allow us to really see the diamond close again. So we can't, if there is Coulomb locate, we can't tell what the addition energy is, but at least it should be larger than 0.3 electron volts. Which is, of course, a very large scale and consistent with barriers just right across a single molecule or maybe a very small number of molecules. So, switching topics once more, actually quite drastically, in a way. We, as you know, did an experiment. This actually was the first thing that we did with graphene after the, you know, the quantized Hall, half-integer quantum Hall papers came out. Was to put aluminum compacts, titanium aluminum compacts, on the graphene. This was with Hubert Hirsch and Pablo Ferri Herrero, Jürgen Ostenhain, in collaboration with Alberto Morpurgo. And so back then we saw a supercurrent through the graphene, so no voltage over a fairly large range of currents. The supercurrent, or the critical current, was gate tunable, slight polar from electrons to holes. In fact, you know, this junction showed all the nice things that you expect from a Josephson junction, including noctopole and Rayleigh reflection at large, or at finite source drain voltage. Shapiro steps when you excite it with RF electric fields, the low magnetic field dependence gives this typical fan over pattern, and at large magnetic fields, even into terminal, we got quantized Hall plateaus. So after that experiment, we didn't actually continue this in this direction for several years. But then two theoretical predictions motivated us to start working on it again. And the first is from Carlo Benacker, already some, well, fairly old prediction, actually from before our paper, really. But he predicted that if you're able to get your electrons at your Fermi energy to within, get your Fermi energy closer than the gap to the charge neutrality point, then you could observe specular Andreev reflection, where, for the usual Andreev reflection, the hole retraces the path of the incoming electron, but in specular Andreev reflection, the hole bounces like light bounces of a mirror. In order to make this happen, you need a large or superconductor with a large gap, larger than the potential fluctuations in the graphene. Another interesting prediction is that, this was actually an old prediction, and Anton Akhmerov brought it to our attention, is that if you look at the Andreev reflection in the quantum Hall regime, and you've got this cartoon picture of skipping orbits where an electron comes in and can either reflect or Andreev reflect, the conductance, the net conductance across the interface basically shows signs of interference. Interference because of the multiple possibilities of, you know, an electron going like this and then Andreev reflecting as a whole, or first Andreev reflecting here and then normally reflecting as a whole and then two holes coming together. So there is basically several paths that can interfere with each other, and some predictions for conductance fluctuations. And again, what you need here is a superconductor contacting your two-dimensional electron system, and it needs to have a large gap, or at least a large critical field which goes together, so that you can access the quantum Hall regime and still have contacts that superconduct. And so with these motivations in mind, we started working on niobium titanium nitride junctions some time ago now, in collaboration with Ten Klepwijk in Delft, who is an expert in mesoscopic superconductivity, and for detectors that are used in astronomy, builds or sputters high quality niobium titanium nitride films. So the critical field is at least 11 Tesla, which is the maximum field that we could reach in our system. Critical temperature, about 15 Kelvin, and the expected gap about 2 millielectron volts. We built two types of devices. The first are SN devices, and the other are SGN, so superconductor graphene normal. And next I'll show you superconductor graphene superconductor devices. In these first devices, in these first devices, what we saw is that as a function of the bias across the structure, first of all, resistances are quite high, about 10 kilo ohm. The graphene should have a resistance of only about a kilo ohm. We know this from another piece of graphene to the side where we can measure the mobility and of the density. The contact between the superconductor and the graphene underneath, we know is 400 to 700 ohms from three terminal measurements. And so what we think causes most of that resistance is damage to the damage to the piece of graphene sitting very close to the superconductor. Damage introduced either by the sputtering process, so the niobium titanium nitride is sputtered, it's a violent process. We do several things to protect the graphene, but probably that wasn't fully successful. Or maybe the high temperatures heat reached and the subsequent thermal expansion and compression could also have been pulling on the graphene. That actually may also be responsible for the nonlinearity that we see in the IV. So this is now DVDI, and you see that it's not constant as a function of bias. This nonlinearity has nothing to do with superconductivity. It occurs, you see that the voltage scale here, this is plus and minus 20 volts, millivolts, and the gap is only 2 millivolts, so that has nothing to do with it. This is at 4 Kelvin. At lower temperature, at 50 millikelvin, we see an additional feature which we think does have to do with superconductivity. And this feature I want to explore or discuss in a little bit more detail. First of all, when we change the gate voltage, then this peak, this zero bias peak in the conductance in the DIDV is always there. It doesn't fluctuate, although it varies gradually from the doped region towards the neutrality point. And what's interesting or maybe remarkable is that the change in conductance between the few millivolt value and the peak is more than a factor of 2. And so, the first thing that you think of for this enhanced conductance is Andreev reflection through a high-quality interface. That is a possibility. That would surprise us because of the way we made the structure, the high-quality interface. But also, if it's just Andreev reflection by itself, it can at most change the conductance increase it by a factor of 2. For every incoming particle, 2 particles are transferred, but not by more than a factor of 2. Looking at the magnetic field dependence, the peak here disappears at several tesla, maybe 4 tesla or so, which if you consider as a scenario where there is an interference, and I'm maybe running ahead a little bit in the argument, that if there is an interference phenomenon, then the enclosed, if a single flux quantum must be enclosed, 4 tesla requires an area of about 1,000 nanometers squared. Looking at the temperature dependence, we see that the peak disappears long before the critical field or the critical temperature of the superconductor is reached. Again, that's 15 Kelvin or so. This is here we see that at about 1 Kelvin, the peak has already disappeared. One thing that at least makes sense is that the scale of the temperature, 1 Kelvin, is comparable to the voltage scale where the conductance enhancement disappears. So I didn't point that out, but it's about a tenth of a millielectron volt. The RMS, or the width of this peak, comparable in order of magnitude to the temperature. We cannot be really firm about what causes this peak, but what we propose is that it's caused by reflectionless tunneling, where an incoming electron can Andreev reflect on the interface, but if it's not a clean interface, it can also normal reflect. And if your normal system is diffusive, it can have another attempt at Andreev reflecting. And if it does, and then reflects here normally, then there are 2 possible paths that this hole can be formed, either the direct Andreev reflection or Andreev reflection here. And again, these 2 can interfere with each other. In fact, they will always, at zero bias and at zero temperature and zero magnetic field, they will always interfere constructively, because the phase developed here and here well, cancels each other.
So, yeah,
but we don't think that we're in the speculative case here because our sample is too dirty and the potential fluctuations are definitely larger than the size of the gap. Yeah. But yeah, it would be different. So these two phases cancel each other, so that you get always contractive interference for these two processes, which means that the net probability for an NRF reflection is actually larger due to interference. And if you then compare the normal, the case where the superconductor is normal, or where you're above the gap, with the subgap conductance, then this actually does produce or does allow more than a factor of two enhancements at zero bias. So the bias kills it, because if electrons come in above the Fermi energy, then the phase here, the electron is above the Fermi energy, the holdup goes back is below the Fermi energy, and now their phases don't unwind or don't cancel each other, so the finite bias makes it go away. Temperature, for the same reason, it introduces the spreading and the energies, and for the same reason makes the interference disappear. In addition, of course, temperature can kill phase coherence or reduce the phase coherence length. And then finally, also a magnetic field will make the phase of the second hole no longer interfere constructively with the phase of the first hole if a flux quantum is enclosed in this loop here.
How large is the distance between the reservoir and the superconductor in the experiment?
It's about 250 nanometers.
How large is the mean free plan?
The mobility of the graphene next to it was about 1 or 2,000, and so at these densities, it's a mean free pad of 10 or 20 nanometers, something like that. So that's what we. How we interpret these measurements. Like I announced, we also did SGS measurements. Here, the device was made in a slightly different way. With the devices made in the previous way, we didn't see, at least when the titanium was thin, we didn't see supercurrents. Maybe I'll skip some of the technicalities. If we put a thin layer of gold here, then we could get rid of a plasma spreader clean step and have less damage to the graphene, and then we actually did see supercurrents, like you can see in this measurement. So here's the zero voltage or zero resistance region. Of course, looking at the measurement, the most striking features are these sharp spikes, but we think they are actually quite uninteresting and caused by self-induced Shapiro steps. So basically, the junction irradiating some energy that can be resonant in the cavity. It's actually compatible with the size of the cavity in which the sample is mounted. And that then comes back and basically causes a response analogous to Shapiro steps. The critical current is gate tunable, like it was in the aluminum compact devices. And again, we see a Fraunhofer pattern with these extra spikes from the what we think is self-induced Shapiro steps. The period from the Fraunhofer pattern is actually quite close, or gives an area that is quite close to the geometrical area of the device that is consistent. So,
just some current, so does it depend on the gate voltage?
Well, here. So in these devices, the critical currents are quite small, like you can see. We've made other devices, maybe I should have put them in the talk also, made again in a different way, where the critical currents were a few tens of nanoamps.
How about the ICRM product? How does it compare with
It's actually much lower. I don't know if it's 10 times or 100 times lower, but it's very low.
Similar to the aluminum?
No, the aluminum was a little bit lower, but not 10 times, maybe 50% or so. 50% or a few times, I don't remember, but not 10 and certainly not 100 times lower.
What exactly is the content? You have a superconductor on graphene. So what actually happens to the electrons? Do they tunnel vertically first and then propagate along graphene, or these edges actually the content?
Well, we think that in our mind they tunnel, they come from the niobium titanium nitride, go through the gold and titanium, and then into the graphene sideways.
So underneath the contact itself, there is a region where the conducting gap induced would be larger than outside. And do you have a measure of that gap in the IV characteristic?
No, in fact. It's a good question, and if you look, for instance, at these measurements here, I focused basically on one thing, because that's the thing that we think we have a fairly robust explanation for. But there's a lot more going on, you know. Like there's the peak is sitting on top of a broader dip, and then the peak actually is a double peak, and it is tempting to assign, for instance, this dip or something else to the gap of the niobium titanium nitride or to the induced gap underneath in the graphene. But the reason we didn't do is that we did some more experiments, like, you know, current anneal, and then look at what happens to all these measurements. And every attempt at an interpretation, like we assign this to that, this feature to that gap or to this gap, somehow breaks down. It's never fully compatible with everything we see, and that's we actually had many discussions and weren't able to be firm about the other features and about assigning it to the induced gap or the gap in the superconductor.
With indium arsenide quantum wire, it seemed to be possible to do.
It's probably true, and actually in the aluminum junctions it's also possible. So there you get, for instance, melted Landreev reflection, which gives a very clear measure of the gap, I think it was 125 microelectron volts, a little bit lower than the gap of the aluminum. So that titanium also plays a role there, and so that makes sense. Here we also saw some features that initially we thought perhaps had to do with melted Landreev reflection, but the energy scales were completely off and it was really impossible. So it was difficult to really say much more about the junction than what I've presented. At least you can say a lot more, but you cannot be sure about it.
What's the penetration depth?
I don't remember the number. I don't remember the number. I would, maybe someone knows here better than me. Maybe Jeannie, would you make a guess?
I don't know.
I'm guessing 10 nanometer, 100 nanometer, something like that, but I'm not sure. So the gap is 2 millielectron volt, I can say. Don't remember. It's also been part of our discussion, but I don't remember the number. Glenn would know. All right. So, let me then come to the final topic. I'm going to go a bit more than an hour. Is that okay? We started a bit late, I guess.
So this always gives more time to discuss.
Thank you. So we had several things in mind when we started building, you know, devices which are completely suspended. So usually when people say suspended graphene, it's suspended above a substrate. But here we wanted to build completely suspended devices on a TEM grid, basically, but then with contacts. So a TEM grid. Either it's one, you know, a continuous piece of metal, and then you have one contact only, or you can make it from an instrument. Well, I guess usually they're metals for avoiding charging of the by the electrons. But one of the things that we had in mind when starting this project was to see how the structure, and really down to the atomic level, you know, think of very narrow constrictions and seeing each of the atoms, how the structure affects the conductance or the current through the device, and also seeing how the current that we can pass through the contacts, well, through the graphene via the contacts, affects the structure. So many measurements have been done where currents affect the structure. I showed you the nanogaps, that is earlier work from Mark, actually, where currents structure affect the structure. You know, Andrian Bachtold, some of the names escape me, but a lot of people, Bachtold Weiss, of course, et cetera. But here we would really be able to follow with, you know, good precision how these two affect each other. And you can also see really in the TEM how constrictions form. I've showed you the results of making a constriction or of making a tiny gap, but we can't really see them form. Maybe we could see layers peel off one by one, which is what we were hoping to see, but when we started the molecule project. There was switching behavior observed, actually, by Mark, where you send, this is on a substrate, you send current through graphene, you make a gap so it's open, but then by bringing up the bias again, you can make it conducting again, and then open and conducting. And I think it's still not really understood what's going on there. So this was all work by Amelia. Quite difficult devices to make, and the TEM measurements were done in the group of Mark Rumeli in Dresden on the FEI Titan. It was operated at 80 kilovolts. The structures are formed by basically making a hole from the back all the way through the substrate, and then the oxide on top is left. Then you make contacts, you e-beam pattern contacts on top of the substrate. Here's the scale bar, so this is about the micron. Then you etch away the remaining oxide, so now you've got four contacts which are kind of suspended, hanging over this larger hole. And then you transfer a graphene flake onto the contacts and align it carefully so that it will land there and stay there, align there. The transfer is done by having PMMA supporting the graphene. And in fact, when you then try to remove the PMMA, you usually also remove the flake. But to avoid that, then Amelia exposed part of the PMMA to the electron beam with a high dose so that it cross-linked and didn't dissolve when you put it in the solvent afterwards. And this actually sort of clamps the graphene in place and it doesn't go away. So it's quite an elaborate process, took some time to develop, but in the end she measured about a dozen of these devices. So this is just after the transfer. If you then current anneal, here is a flake that just sits kind of here, a smaller piece. If you then current anneal, you get a very clean graphene, like you can see here. This is a TEM, you just see right through, there is no contamination visible. First observation is, and now I'm going to have to juggle a little bit. This is the first time I tried this. Let's see how this goes. I'm going to juggle between the images and movies. So this is the formation of a constriction. And maybe I'll start the movie and then start explaining. So what's going on here is you're seeing the image in the TEM. It's actually less sharp than on the computer monitor, but still visible. We're passing a large current through, and the current is heating up the graphene so that a gap develops from the side. And here you see the other edge of the graphene. And in fact, maybe you didn't.
But is the other edge running away?
It's outside the field of view. It's kind of, you know, they're trying to find back where the gap is forming. Here it is again. And at some point, you'll see again the other edge of the graphene. It's over here is the gap that's forming. What's interesting is you see actually two films. So here it's really completely broken. Here it's a multi-layer device, and here some of the layers are peeling off. They reach the other end and then come back. And then just at the end, you see the two pieces come together and very quickly rupture. So at some point, when you know the constriction here was maybe this is 100 nanometer, when it was about 100 nanometer wide, or maybe 150 in this case, eventually it broke. So a lot of things happened there.
You the steps are multi-layers?
Yeah, so this is several layers, patches. Actually, I'll say more about how these patches can get there later on. Some of them are formed by, well, I'll come back to it.
Do you have any idea what temperature is?
We didn't have a way to measure the temperature in this measurement. What I can say is that there have been measurements in another group where they had a flake on a temp grid, conducting temp grid, and then had an STM coming down, and they also could do transport measurements. And in some of their measurements, they had gold particles deposited that they had, you know, deposited, and from the melting temperature of the gold and where they evaporated, they could guess that it's on the order of 2,000 Kelvin. So it gets very hot. And we think that for us, I mean, we have similar bias. The bias is a few volts. We have a few volts over this flake, even the tiny constriction. These are measurements done at fixed voltage bias, and we just measure the current, and the current is about a milliampere, as you can see. So a lot of things happening. Maybe you can ask me later to show it again if you like. But I have more things to show.
So this rupturing, is it along grain boundaries or?
As far as we can tell, I think not. As far as we can tell, no. So there are. I'll show a high resolution image in a moment. So here is another device. The scale is much smaller now. The scale bar was 100 nanometer in the previous image. Now we're really zooming in on a tiny constriction, again with 3 volts across the constriction. Now a smaller current, 80 microamps, but nevertheless 80 microamps going through something of a few, 2-3 nanometers wide. And let me juggle back to the movie because it's really more informative than the still images. So for the first part of this movie, I think not so much happens. There you begin to see how the constriction is forming with a kink, still touching in 2 places, now touching in 1 place. And then finally it ruptures. And actually, if you look here at the... if you look...
sides, they really move on with respect to that.
Yeah. So the whole thing is suspended on the contacts. It's getting hot. There is thermal strain. And in fact, what I wanted to point out is precisely about this point. You see that after breaking, just before breaking, there the two pieces left and right are of course lined up because it's one continuous piece. And then right after, they sort of shift with respect to each other, which says that. Until it broke, there was a significant amount of mechanical strain that wanted to pull apart these two pieces. That wanted to pull apart these two pieces, but even this constriction of at this moment about 1 nanometer helped together the pieces until finally it broke, and then the structure could relax to.
What was graphene? On the side strain, or is this where the metallic supports which were deformed?
We couldn't really tell, I guess. I mean, when we deposit the graphene, presumably it's kind of not under too much strain. But then, when you start heating the thing, everything will start working. Both the graphene will expand and contract.
Do you have some thin STM image off of the metallic contact?
No. So you have to choose a field of view, and either you get a good resolution or a large view. And, actually, this is smaller than our field of view of the same device. We have the movie is taken actually in a larger field of view, but not all the way to the context.
So, you were breaking it by running a current, by driving
yes.
a current. What is the direction of the current here?
Well, from this side to that side. So this is all graphene, and this is air. It's empty. The other thing you can see, at least I hope you can see it, in the bottom of this slide, is really the jumps in the conductance, which are accompanied by jumps in the structure. So in the kink, so going from two places where there is contact to one, the current or the conductance goes down, current goes down, and then when the kink straightens out again, it goes down, and then eventually, of course, the current drops when the two pieces break apart.
So when you take the movie, it's with them, right?
Yep.
So you shoot high energy electrons to your
80 kilo electron volt.
It can also influence your.
They do knock. They are the energy is high enough to knock out electrons on the edges, but not in the bulk. And so, yeah, that's what we can say. So they will. But what we can say is that if we only image and switch off the current, then the device doesn't change very much, except some effects that I'll show now in a moment, but that they definitely don't form constrictions or anything like that.
In the jumps in conductance, if you translate it, in current, if you translate it into conductance of Ollard?
That's a good question. Well, we can do it, right? So it's 3 volts divided by, let's round off, 30 microvolts. So it's 100 kilo ohm, I guess.
Just a few kilo.
100 kilo ohm, and then here maybe it was, let's round off, 70 kilo ohm, something like that.
You're losing one channel or two channels.
Yeah, maybe, but part of the voltage, of course, will drop outside, so there is a serious resistance. But most of it is going to drop in the tiny bridge.
When the ripping is occurring, do you have any information on what happens to the edges? What is the structure of the edges? They curl, do they passivate somehow?
So we can say a few things about them. The first is here's a high resolution image, and so yeah, you can see that some of the this is the constriction from here to here. This is air, and then here it's graphene. You see that it's really crystalline, even when the constriction has narrowed down to, in this case, about 10 nanometer. And these edges look really quite smooth, even at the atomic level. Another thing that you can see, and I'll say a bit more about that, is that the edges actually are quite high contrast. This is not actually. Here you can see it's quite high contrast, and this suggests that it's probably a bilayer in this case. And it's probably not two layers that are like that, but two layers that lower their energy by connecting. And in fact, in a moment I'll show you some more movies that further support this picture.
Can it be that the frame is the layer?
Well, and thereby enhancing the contrast. It could be, but the images or the movies that I'll show you later tell you that it's probably not. Yeah. Before I go there, I think it's the next slide. Before I go there, I want to point out another observation, and this is also quite interesting. I don't think we don't have a really good understanding of why this is so, but what you're looking at is the current density before the constriction breaks. So first it kind of gradually gets narrower, and at some point it suddenly breaks and it's over. And so what we plot is that point, that current density, as a function of the width. And what we see is that whereas wide constrictions, this is also true for constrictions on substrates, break at current densities of the order of 10 to the 7 ampere per square centimeter. For narrow constrictions, the current densities are about two orders of magnitude larger. Actually, there was one other observation of such a high current density in a narrow constriction. Here we really see, as a function of the width for several devices, the current density where it breaks. And you can try to think about why that may be. Perhaps there is something really interesting to say about it. Perhaps it's a more mundane explanation that samples that happen to be cleaner, of course, allow a higher current density. If there are no contaminants or defects, you can allow a high current density. And if there are no contaminants, there is also less of a trigger to suddenly rupture what remains. So maybe that's the explanation, or maybe there is some more physics or deeper physics behind it. So I want to now show you another movie that I think will help answer your question. So you're looking at a piece of graphene and current is going through. This is where the graphene ends. Here there's some junk on top and also some central layers. And you already see some fronts that are moving. So this is basically a multi-layer device. You see a front moving, coming down. So it's kind of sublimating a layer. And then another one was already going the other way. You see it's still moving here. There will be more happening in a moment. Here you see another.
What's happening? Is it evaporation?
Yeah. So it's, and here you see one. It's a nice one. It reaches the end. It bounces back. Here it again bounces back. So several times when such a front where sublimation occurs and propagates reaches an edge of a flake or reaches an edge of a piece sitting on top, well, ending and with a larger piece below. It bounces back. It's really cool to see. Actually, I need to show part of that again. No. Or maybe not. Okay, but I hope you saw what happens. And
what the place where it finally breaks is between the central point, between the external gates?
Yeah, typically it's somewhere central, and that makes sense because that's where it gets the hottest, because it's the farthest away from the contacts that can evacuate the heat.
What does it mean, bouncing back?
What causes it? Or
what does it mean?
That's why I wanted to show the movie again. But you can sort of see it here, if your piece of contrast good enough. So you see. Not really. Basically, what happens is you saw these lines moving over the screen, I think. I hope. And so the lines are the boundaries that separate pieces of graphene of different thicknesses. So basically, a piece of graphene is sublimating, and the sublimated area just increases in size, and then eventually reaches the edge of the graphene. And when the sublimated front, or the sublimation front, reaches the edge, another sublimation front moves back.
All right. So
and it really is
so
like
you get rid of the top layers, and you start dealing with
immediately. And this was some observations like this, although on a much smaller.
Are you sure it was the edge, not the fold, not that you just got rid of? Material continues, which was...
Well, exactly. That's what we think happened. So this is also why we think that it's not that the enhanced contrast that we saw is not because it's just curling up for some reason, but it's because really two layers that are on top of each other can actually lower their energy at the edge by reconstructing and finding each other. And in fact, these measurements suggest that you can have several of these nested into each other, or it arrives and
then. Was just flipped over. What you had was flipped over.
Um, Yeah, but there's no reason why it would be flipped over. The graphene, when we transfer it, is attached to the PMMA, and it's not going to, like, on a large scale. These are 50 nanometer scale bars, so it's quite large scale. It's not going to flip over, and certainly not multiple times fold onto each other. So these guys saw similar things happening of a front reaching an edge and then coming back, although on a much smaller spatial dimension, on a much smaller scale.
You always see these high contrast edges. You never see like a monolayer?
Yes, we do actually. I didn't point that out. But sometimes you see, for instance, a front, and then the end of it doesn't have that contrast, and then we conclude it's a single layer.
Okay.
So then the final thing, and here I don't really need the movie. The movie doesn't really show more than the still images. But here is a piece. Well, it was one continuous piece, and we applied large enough current so that it broke. And those two separate pieces were there, and you know the current briefly dropped. But then, because of mechanical stress in the structure, after breaking, the two pieces moved onto each other and overlapped and started conducting again because they just literally touch. And that's what you see here. And the dashed lines sort of indicate, or the dots indicate the extremities of the two pieces, we think.
There's another layer below? Or?
So there are two layers like this. And in fact, in this measurement, we think that each of them is a bilayer. And then nothing underneath that.
So the dots are along what? Along the break,
we think,
or?
Along the end of one layer and the end of the other layer, and they overlap. So this is the end of the left layer, and this is the end of the right layer. And then again, we pass current. And at some point, and it happens in the movie really abruptly, that's why the image is just as good as the movie, you go from here to here. And so the two pieces, they were separate pieces, actually fuse. And it's even more remarkable because we think each of them are bilayers. And so they form one continuous sheet again. And when that happens, the current jumps up. So here, this little jump is when the overlap suddenly increases a little bit because of some mechanical strain. And then here, there's a big spike. And that's when the two pieces that were in contact fuse and become one continuous piece. And then, as usual, when you keep applying the high bias, eventually the constriction is formed again. You know, these cracks develop, and at the end it breaks.
How come you don't have like a dislocation or something? To recombine, they should be perfectly aligned. Yes.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So can you save it? Can you resolve the crystallinity of this region?
It's a good question. I don't think that we have images of atomic resolution during such processes. This we've seen several times, maybe four times, and you know every measurement is basically a few minutes and then it's over, right? Because we end with breakdown. So it's kind of a pity because it's a lot of work to make the devices.
But the fact that it ruptures at the same place where it fuses probably means that it's not ideal, huh? That you have some grain boundaries or something.
I will have to discuss with Amelia. I don't know if she's considered this. I haven't thought about it. Maybe, okay, I really should wrap up. Maybe I'll do the last part real quick and you can ask me. But the last thing we see, I'm going to really be fast, is when we don't apply the current, but image just at 80 kilo volt at room temperature, then this is often in a TEM, also in a SEM, you get the position of amorphous carbon. And you can even, you see it as kind of junk ending up on your substrate more and more over time. And you even can form small holes. 80 kV is not usually enough, but if there is a little defect, then it can be enough to, and make the defect larger and make a little hole. If afterwards we again pass a large current, then the patches of amorphous carbon that are sitting on the graphene actually gradually transform into crystalline graphene. And that's what you see here in this sequence of images. Maybe I'll skip the movies. Here's a high-resolution image in the Fourier transform. And what's interesting is that in the part where there's the patch, the newly formed patch on top of the underlying layer, you see that there is a misalignment between the two of 22 degrees in this case. So what we think is happening is that the heat, there is no catalyst, just heat, that the heat is providing enough energy so that the amorphous carbon can recrystallize and form nice patches of graphene again, up to 100 by 100 nanometer. The role of the substrate, we think, is just to give some mechanical stability through van der Waals. You know, if you look at molecular dynamic simulations of carbon atoms flying in vacuum, they're not going to form sheets. They're going to curl up. But presumably, the substrate stabilizes without interacting so strongly that the lattices align. And then, actually, the people in Dresden, another group, also did, so Avtoshenko and Kuniberti group, did molecular dynamics simulations of this process. And when they go from 600 to 1200 to finally 1800 Kelvin, they see that indeed crystalline graphene forms starting from patches of amorphous carbon, a fraction of a nanometer above the substrates. When you have made a hole in the graphene with the electron beam and then have this amorphous carbon around, the hole can also heal out. So the amorphous, here it's gone. So the amorphous carbon just finds its way. Now it's not supported by a substrate underneath, but supported by the substrate or by the graphene itself to the side, which then kind of grows and manages to make bridges that cross that hole. And in the movie, you see how chains of carbons like can wiggle around and maybe find chains of carbons on the other end. So, summarizing what I've talked about, four topics, quite different things. We've built bilayer graphene devices on boron nitride, so a boron nitride sandwich below and above, with a bottom gate and split top gates, like you can see here, which allowed us to confine electrons without graphene edges, purely electrostatically, and see Coulomb blockade. We could even see contact conductance, which is actually harder than seeing Coulomb blockade. And this was made possible in part by this AFM scraping mechanical cleaning technique. By controllably making tiny gaps, we could create graphene electrodes that can make contact to molecules. They are completely stable at room temperature and gateable. The superconducting contacts, nitrogen, titanium nitride with more than 11 Tesla critical fields, we saw a zero bias conductance peak at energies 10 times below the gap, which we interpret in terms of reflection as tunneling for the SGS to be just called the Josephson junction. And then finally, in devices where we can measure transport and in situ do transmission electron microscopy, we see a variety of things, such as seeing how constrictions form. You observe that the breakdown current density sharply increases as the constrictions get smaller. Layers can burn off one after another, kind of helped by this reconstructed edges. Two overlapping pieces can fuse. Amorphous carbon we see recrystallize into graphene patches up to 100 nanometers by 100 nanometers, and holes of a few, like let's say 5 nanometers, can be healed out as well. So I think I've mentioned most of the people along the way, along these various projects. A lot of people contributed, and from my group, it was mostly Stankosis for the bilayers, Victor with Mikhail for the superconducting devices, and Amelia with Ferry for the molecular junctions, and Amelia for the 10 devices in collaboration with Mark Rubin's group in Dresden. Thanks very much.
You mentioned in production something about transport through windows. But then you have not discussed it.
Yeah, because I realized that was already go.
Can you say what wrinkles do?
So the wrinkles, these devices are made by, this is actually a joint project with Cees Dekker and his group, but it started by making nanopores in graphene and seeing DNA pass through the nanopores. And these devices were made by transferring graphene, getting it on the surface of water without any PMMA, just, there is also PMMA. Actually, it was another polymer. And then lowering the water level until, and pushing with a needle to align it. This is done in a microscope, so you just see through it. And then finally, the graphene arrives where you want it to be. And the water drains, as the water is drained and evacuates, wrinkles are formed. Actually, I have beautiful movies I can show you later of how that happens. And for the DNA measurements or the translocation measurements, that didn't matter so much, but we were interested to use the same transfer technique to build our source, all sorts of things like the boron nitride. In the end, we thought that the water wasn't going to be good for the mobility, so we didn't do that. But at least we measured transport through some of these wrinkled devices, so really quite wrinkled. And the observation, the main point was that the mobility on silicon oxide was comparable to what it was without the wrinkles. That's the main thing. So the wrinkles that we induced, didn't induce enough curvature or anything like that to create scattering that degraded the mobility. You've measured the suspended stretch devices where there are also wrinkles.
Well, I think it's consistent. We didn't publish the data, but mainly it's we find that smooth wrinkles does not affect mobility much. But I think what we find, I don't know if you see something similar, I'm interested, is that the quantum Pauli effect usually can be screwed up. What we find is you can have reasonably high mobility but a very bad, ugly looking quantum Pauli effect. Yeah. I mean, the plateaus are all over the place. So, do you have magnetic transfer data?
I have to think. This was a long time ago that we did the measurements, although the student now plans to write it up just to get another paper. I don't think we have quantum Hall measurements for that. And I'm not sure if we tried. I'll look it up and tell you. Yeah. Right. Yeah, sorry for going over time.